Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I'm passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so that's what we explore on this podcast. Before we get started, I want to tell you about something. I have a site that I just created. For a long time, I've been doing these video writing prompts, and I finally put them all into an actual website. And it's videowritingprompts.com, and you should go check it out. I have lots and lots of writing prompts. I'm in the process right now of setting up systems so that you can just download the videos straight from that website, and you'll have it if YouTube is blocked at your school, or if the internet goes down, whatever, you can still have those writing prompts. They're separated out by genre, they're high interest. Anyway, I would love if you would go check that out. So again, it is videowritingprompts.com. And let's go ahead and get started. So I've been teaching at the college level for a little over 3 years. And every time I visit one of my pre-service teachers, you know, my students who are in their practicum, I'm struck by how fast the time seems to go by. It's easy to forget the frantic pace of teaching with the bells and announcements and interruptions that occur on a regular basis. It's easy to forget what it's like to be a teacher. It's easy to forget, you know, what it was like to have to hold the urge to use the restroom for 2 hours and to just be dying by the end of it and have to bookline my way through the hallway knowing that I'm going to cut short my 22-minute lunch period. I mean, those days are gone right now for me. And I remember vividly what it was like. But every time I visit one of my current students in my cohort who's teaching, I'm just struck by this frantic pace of teaching. Most teachers I know have this crowded curriculum map, and they're constantly having to teach new standards and skills and concepts. And then this is kind of punctuated by fire drills and assemblies and field trips and testing days and you name it, right? So how do we make time for projects? How do we make time for project-based learning and design thinking when we already have such crowded days? It can feel like you're simply adding another item onto an already crowded plate, but really PBL isn't about adding anything to your plate. It's about rearranging your plate so that the students are working at a deeper level. Now, how does that actually work? I mean, that sounds great, right? That's what we're going to explore today. And again, I want to tell you, I don't have all the answers here. I had projects that went painfully long that students didn't finish. I had times where projects didn't work at all. I had times when I planned a longer amount of time for a project and then they were done really fast and I was scrambling to figure out what to do lesson planning wise. I get it. There are so many human dynamics at work when it comes to doing PBL in the classroom. So even though I'm going to be sharing strategies about what I have found that has worked, understand that some of this is from observation, some of this is from other amazing teachers that I've gotten a chance to watch, and a lot of this is just kind of from trial and error. So let's go ahead and talk about 7 strategies for maximizing time for project-based learning. Number 1, less teacher talk. Now, this was the hardest for me. Direct instruction can feel really efficient as a way to convey information, and it is. I mean, you talk, they listen, they take notes, you're good. But with PBL, students spend more time doing the work themselves. They're the ones asking the questions, and they find the answers on their own. Sometimes I'm a guide helping them out one-on-one. Other times I'm more of a curator, sharing specific resources they will need. Sometimes I'm pulling small groups. Sometimes I'm meeting one-on-one. Sometimes I'm just wandering around the classroom, observing and answering and kind of putting out fires when I need to. But the goal here is simple. When you spend less time talking, you encourage your students to spend more time working. And that time when they're working, when they're wrestling with ideas, when they're engaged in peer discourse, when they're reading things on their own, when they're doing that in a project, you're actually maximizing time. It can feel really counterintuitive because that can feel slower. But again, they're going to learn it at a deeper level. No, this isn't just about spending less time on direct instruction. It's the idea of spending less time explaining directions as students work on a project. Instead of giving really long directions, I learned that I would need to just write the directions quickly on the board and say, have at it, go for it. And honestly, I mean, I did a time audit before, and I wanted to see how we were spending time in class in the midst of a project. At the time, I had an intern, and that person's job was to observe me. And what I found was really surprising, that we were spending, first of all, students were spending a lot of time answering my questions and not asking their own questions. And this was in the midst of a PBL unit. But the second was that I was spending a lot of time explaining how to do aspects of the project instead of letting them discover how to do those things. And so that was a really hard adjustment for me to make. And honestly, it took years for me to let go of some of that control and let them figure things out a little more on their own. Second idea is to shorten the timeline, but to also build wiggle room into it. Have you ever noticed that students tend to waste time at the beginning or middle of a project, and then they rush toward the end to get it done? Well, it turns out that you will actually work harder on a task when you're close to finishing it. There's some fascinating research on this. This is why it helps to, you know, break up a large project into smaller tasks and then focus on those specific tasks, because the closer you are to finishing a task, the faster you tend to work. And by contrast, there's an idea called Parkinson's Law that explains that work expands to the time allotted. Now, there's a great podcast called Planet Money that I love. It's an NPR podcast. And if you check out the episode that's linked in this blog post, you'll see that they actually encouraged somebody to make a whole podcast episode in a day rather than a week. And to their surprise, it actually got done. And the idea is, again, that we will waste time if we're allowed to waste time. So if you give yourselves 3 weeks to do a project and it should only take 2 weeks, you'll often find that you only get it done in 3 weeks. You don't get it done in the 2 weeks that it should have taken you. And again, it's this idea that work expands to the allotted time. Now, I get it. There are definitely students who will rush through projects and finish early, and that's a whole different issue. But often students will spend longer than normal on a project because the timelines are too loose. I found that it's easier to set tighter deadlines and then give students additional days after if we need to, rather than just having super loose time deadlines. It also helps to break projects into phases. Now, this is one of the reasons I love design thinking. It's one of the reasons why we built phases into the launch process. You can check it out again on this blog post. But it's the idea that students will work through inquiry, research, ideation, prototyping, and revision in these distinct phases that lead up to the launch. I think it also helps to have students keep track of their own progress by asking them to engage in project management. And again, the more they engage in this project management, the better off they'll be in terms of time management. So again, that's number two, shorten the time deadline, so tighter time deadlines, but then more wiggle room in terms of giving them some extra slack if you need to. Number three is to focus on quality over quantity. Now, when I first began teaching, I would wait for the slowest student to finish an assignment before moving on as a class. So when it took a student 35 minutes to write a paragraph, we would all take 35 minutes. And what happened was a lot of students were just sitting around waiting. Now, I would sometimes add an enrichment activity, but it was optional and kids were still, again, kind of bored. Later, when I had them do a student survey to see how I was as a teaching, to my surprise, one of the biggest complaints was that they thought class was moving too slowly. Several students mentioned this. And finally, I realized that we could move faster and I could just excuse students from a second assignment and allow them to finish that first assignment. And this was a big aha moment for me. It was the realization that they don't all need to be doing the exact same amount of work all the time. So during the warm up, I would say something like, try and write at least a paragraph. Many of you will do, you know, three or four paragraphs during this time. But try to aim for one. And so we might spend 15 minutes, and some kids are doing two or three paragraphs, and some kids are only doing one, but it's okay. And this is the whole idea of flexible assignments. It's the idea of giving students the permission to do more or to do less, and kind of having loosely structured assignments. I no longer had my students getting bored and off task, because they were done early, and I also didn't have the students who were stressed because they felt like they were falling behind. And this is one of the core ideas of focusing on quality over quantity. It's the concept that the system should fit the student rather than making the student fit into the system. And so again, this is one of those times where by creating these flexible assignments and focusing on the quality of work rather than the quantity of work, we actually were able to accomplish more. And the same was true when we switched to PBL. So when we worked on blogging projects, I had students who wrote 10 blog posts and others who wrote 3, and that was okay. I had students who wrote 2,000 words and others who wrote 400 words. Now, sometimes kids had a hard time with this, and at the very beginning, I would have to kind of tell them, look, this is about equity, and equity is not the same as equality. Equity is not the same as sameness. Equity is the idea of every person reaching their full potential. And the metaphor I would use, or the example I would use is, look, we all do silent reading. And during silent reading time, some of you read 10 pages, some of you read 4 pages, and that's okay, right? Because the goal is to reach your own individual potential. So when we would do projects, when we shifted toward a PBL model, I had to do the same thing and tell students, it's okay. We are going to, some of you are going to do more, some of you are going to do less, and that's okay. Number 4, use structures to save time. Early on in my PBL journey, I told students, I want you to create a documentary. You need to develop a plan and then make it happen. Well, it didn't happen. Students stood around just talking and staring and doing nothing. The larger project was too daunting, and they just couldn't wrap their brains around it. It was too much to break down the tasks. So then I began to incorporate structures that would build interdependence and collaboration. And I realized that structures were actually vital for our projects. Structures are vital for creative productivity and time management. It turns out people who are inexperienced at a task often fail to plan and have more false starts and mistakes than those who are experts. Experts actually, in almost every field, will tend to plan more and use more structures. It was fascinating research around that. So the idea is that structures are actually vital. You want to be using structures. Structures provide the necessary creative constraint that push divergent thinking. They help facilitate the creative work. They allow people to work interdependently and creatively and collaboratively. And you see this all the time in the, quote, real world. Pixar uses the brain trust concept, and countless different companies use this radical candor structure. There's a great book called Radical Candor. I love it, on peer feedback. And you see this again in almost every single industry and discipline. They have frameworks. If writers use writers' workshops in the publishing process, engineers use the engineering process, scientists use the scientific method, all kinds of designers use a design thinking framework. And when we incorporate these frameworks into our PBL units, we are not only saving time, but we're also teaching students how to do creative work in different disciplines. We're mirroring the way that documentarians work and authors work and scientists work and engineers work, and they're learning how to think in those domains. Number 5 is to chunk your standards. Now, a lot of you are already doing this. I'm guessing if you're listening to this podcast, this is probably going to be a duh idea, but it's the idea of linking standards that are related to each other. So linking skill standards to concept standards and practicing both at the same time. If there's a standard in one thing and then three standards that are very similar, that you put them all into the same project, and students are working on them holistically rather than sequentially and systematically. Number six is to teach new content through the project rather than having students learn the content first and take a project. So we often think about projects as like culminating projects where they're done with a unit, then we take 3 or 4 days and do a project. The idea of project-based learning is that you learn through the project rather than learning before the project. And I love this. It's something that the Buck Institute has brought up, and that was a huge paradigm shift for me as I was moving into a more PBL model myself, was to incorporate things like direct instruction and guided practice into the project rather than doing all those things first and then moving into kind of open project time. And so when that happens, you save a lot of time because you're not adding the project into an already crowded curriculum. You're using the project as the framework that you're doing as you develop and design your units and lessons. Then the final time-saving thing is to just assess as you go. So instead of stopping to take tests and quizzes, you assess in the moment. You walk around and you observe. You have students do peer assessment and self-assessment, fill out quick Google Forms. You might have them do a concept map. But the idea is that they're just assessing frequently in a way that saves time rather than stopping the project and then going and taking an assessment. And so that's the final way to maximize time for PBL. Ultimately, project-based learning involves a different way of thinking. It's about choosing quality over quantity and about shifting towards student ownership. While it can feel like things are moving more slowly in PBL, you can actually accomplish a lot more and learn at a deeper level when you move toward a PBL framework. If you're interested in PBL, please check out my site. It's spencerauthor.com. There's a PBL toolkit there. There's a free webinar you can do. And really, I would recommend just get started with one project-based learning unit. Just try one, see how it goes, and chances are you'll find that you're actually using your time more wisely when you shift toward a PBL model and framework and approach. So thank you for listening to the Creative Classroom Podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you like this podcast, would you leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts? And will you tell a friend about this? Thank you again for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.